I next met with Dr. Pam Koontz, and to begin, we chatted about gastroesophageal cancer, and Dr. Koontz began by providing a macro perspective on the disease.
One of the main things that I think has happened is how we look at GE junction cancers. And previously, I think gastric, esophageal, and GE junction cancers were really all lumped together. And I think we're learning increasingly that these are different diseases. Gastric in particular, which we can certainly talk about later, is probably many diseases. And so I think one study, the CROSS trial that came out, I think was a really important trial, though it included some esophageal, I think really had a predominance of GE junction cancers, and I think really changed standard practice in terms of how we should be managing that disease. So that was a study that looked at neoadjuvant chemoradiation in that disease with carboplatin and paclitaxel concurrent with radiation. And then that looked at, followed by surgery, and then there was no postoperative treatment. And the arm that contained the chemoradiation did better. And so I think that that's now really the standard for how we treat GE junction cancers. All of those patients should really be getting neoadjuvant chemoradiation prior to surgery.
What's your experience with the CROSS regimen, particularly with older patients?
So, you know, initially I was really nervous about that, Neil. I think that's a good question. I think I was nervous that my older patients would not tolerate it well. I actually think it's a pretty well-tolerated regimen. I think I was very familiar and comfortable using a fluoropyrimidine-based regimen with radiation. That certainly had been my practice prior to the CROSS trial. We used a lot of concurrent 5-FU or capecitabine with radiation, normally postoperatively in that setting. So I was nervous about platinum and taxanes concurrently, but I think that they're actually pretty well tolerated. So I haven't seen a pattern of difficulty, particularly in older patients. The doses, I think, are pretty well tolerated.
What are some of the research strategies that are being considered in the adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting?
So we're looking certainly at biologic agents in this setting. So there is currently an ongoing RTOG cooperative group trial looking at trastuzumab neoadjuvantly. So looking at sort of a cross-trial-like regimen, but plus or minus trastuzumab. I think that's interesting. The question of looking at trastuzumab adjuvantly is something that's being looked at, a la, you know, can we borrow from our breast oncology colleagues and looking at adjuvant trastuzumab like they would for HER2-positive patients, of which about 20% of patients with gastric and GE junction adenocarcinomas would be.
In terms of those two strategies, you know, trastuzumab seems like it doesn't really add very much in terms of risk or toxicity. Mm-hmm. Seems like, you know, it's going to add something to the efficacy. How would you feel about those two strategies, or do you ever utilize those strategies of neoadjuvant trastuzumab or adjuvant trastuzumab outside a trial setting?
So I'm sort of a purist when it comes to using and interpreting data. You know, I think we've learned from other disease settings that even if it works in breast, it may not work in gastric. So for example, lapatinib in the metastatic setting for HER2-positive disease doesn't work in gastric and it does in breast. And it's hard to know why that is. I think until we really have a rigorous, prospective, randomized clinical trial that proves that it works, I tend to not extrapolate. I get lots of questions from colleagues, both in academic and non-academic settings. I think it probably, you know, if you had a really high-risk patient who is HER2-positive that you're treating with curative intent, and in the adjuvant setting, I think really there's a big research question of if we're now treating patients with the CROSS trial, that trial did not give postoperative treatment. What do you do in the postoperative setting if you still have residual disease seen on pathology? And so I think that that group of patients is getting treated a whole number of different ways. If they're HER2 negative, do you give them additional cytotoxic chemotherapy? That's my practice. I usually give them an additional 3 to 4 months to kind of round out 6 months of perioperative treatment.
With what?
I usually use platinum fluoropyrimidine, even though they've had carboplatin to begin with. I mean, you could round it out with carboplatin, but I think it makes me nervous to not give them anything, but that is not data-driven. that's extrapolating a little bit from the MAGIC and McDonald, you know, treatments of giving some form of postoperative treatment. How do you treat patients adjuvantly who have HER2-positive disease? I mean, right now I'm not using adjuvant trastuzumab. I have seen colleagues do that, but it's not data-driven.
So you brought up the issue of HER2-positive disease, and I wanted to ask you about management of metastatic disease, and maybe we can start out with HER2-positive, although, as you say, it is a minority. And I'm curious where things stand today. You mentioned the lapatinib study that was disappointing, although, I mean, lapatinib is not exactly a home run in breast cancer. You know, it's a lot of toxicity. It's, you know, not quite the same as trastuzumab. But where are we in terms of taking the next step? What are some of the key steps forward in HER2-positive gastric cancer? One, of course, everybody asks about are the new drugs, pertuzumab and T-DM1 in breast cancer, are these being studied in gastric?
So those are indeed being looked at in prospective clinical trials. I think that one that is, I think, very exciting is looking at trastuzumab emtansine, so T-DM1, which is a drug-antibody conjugate used, you know, now approved. Everyone, I think, us GI oncologists, it's sort of new to us, but the community docs are probably more familiar using it than we are. And there is an ongoing prospective large multinational trial looking at that. It was originally designed as a three-arm study looking at once every 3 week T-DM1, weekly T-DM1, and then the third arm was paclitaxel by itself. And that's something that I think anticipate in the next year or two will be completed with accrual, but we probably won't have results for a few years. I think we're all very excited about that study.
These trials are running, up and running now?
Yes, these trials, the T-DM1 study is up and running. Our institution has it open, as I know many U.S. institutions do. It's an international study.
What about pertuzumab? You know, to me and a lot of people, it was kind of a big surprise in terms of the magnitude of how much it added to trastuzumab with chemotherapy and breast cancer. Is that kind of strategy being looked at?
So that is also being looked at in prospective studies. I think ways to overcome trastuzumab resistance, I think, is something that's certainly being pioneered by the breast oncologists. And hopefully we can learn from some of the lessons that they've already, you know, paved the way for in looking at ways of overcoming resistance. So can you combine biologics? Are there other ways? I know there are some other novel agents looking at HER2-3 antibody conjugates. So I think that this is a really exciting area. I think that it's, you know, a really important question is, are those advantages really only going to be limited to the HER2 traditionally positive patients?
I see that you have a case of HER2-positive disease you brought in here today, 55-year-old man. Can you talk a little bit about him and what happened with him?
Sure. So this was a gentleman who had a bulky T3N1 GE junction adenocarcinoma. And as we spoke earlier about the shift in standard practice recently over the last year or so, we used the CROSS regimen. So he was treated neoadjuvantly with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and concurrent radiation. Tolerated that very well, subsequently went on to get an Ivor Lewis esophagectomy. And then we were faced with the fact that he still had residual disease, which is very common, residual disease seen at the time of surgical removal. And so then we were faced with the question of what to do next for him. He did have HER2-positive disease. And one point to make is that I think not a lot of people are testing for HER2-positive disease in this setting. I think that it's not yet reflexive. There really is no standard treatment adjuvantly using trastuzumab or HER2-directed agents in this setting. As I'd mentioned, the only trial or clinical trial application would be the RTOG study for these patients. He did not get that. So then we're left with, do you do nothing, which is what the CROSS trial did? Would you offer him cytotoxic chemotherapy? Or would you offer him some form of cytotoxic, perhaps followed by a year of trastuzumab, sort of a la the treatment of breast cancer? And this was a patient that actually I saw in consultation in referral, and he had received no further adjuvant therapy. I think that's actually not a wrong answer. I mean, that is certainly how patients in the CROSS trial were treated. I think you'll get many different answers from other oncologists. We typically, as I'd mentioned earlier, will give 3 months of adjuvant platinum fluoropyrimidine treatment.
It kind of reminds me a little bit about some of the debates that are going on, believe it or not, in lung cancer with locally advanced disease about whether to use EGFR TKIs or ALK inhibitors, because, you know, we know that they'll shrink the tumor down. We know it's going to be a smaller radiation field. It is being done in a clinical trial, but most of the investigators are saying, well, don't do it right now outside a trial. Same thing here. Again, this man, I think more going back to the NIU, I don't know how educated he was, or, you know, whether he was looking up stuff, or, you know, he could have been a physician for all I know. If he was an oncologist, I think he might have been saying, hey, can you put a little trastuzumab in my neoadjuvant therapy?
Right. You know, I think that we're going to see over the next few years continued benefit of trastuzumab in settings outside of the metastatic setting. I do think that we've seen a benefit in the metastatic setting. I mean, as we know, in other GI cancers, that doesn't always apply and mean that it'll work in the adjuvant setting, per bevacizumab not working in the adjuvant setting, and it works in metastatic for colorectal cancer. So I think the jury is still out, but I'm excited about this for this subset of patients. But it's only about, you know, 1 in 5 patients that can benefit from this.
So let's talk about HER2-negative gastroesophageal cancer in terms of new developments. I guess one big story over the last year or so has been ramucirumab. First, we saw it by itself, and now more recently, we've seen it with chemotherapy with a taxane. Can you maybe talk a little bit about what ramucirumab is and what we know about it at this point?
Sure. So ramucirumab was first studied in second-line setting versus placebo and showed a couple-month benefit over placebo in the second-line setting. It is an antibody that targets VEGF. And so unlike bevacizumab, which targets the VEGF ligand, this targets the VEGF receptor. And I think that the real big question is, as you know, Neil, the Avogast trial was negative. That looked at bevacizumab in the metastatic first-line setting for gastroesophageal cancer. And that trial was a very heterogeneous trial, enrolled patients from all over the world, but it was primarily Asian patients, and really was one of the first trials to show incredible geographic heterogeneity in terms of responses. So then we looked, and sorry, fast forward, you asked me about ramucirumab, so I'll get back to that, but I'm trying to make the point that I think ramucirumab study looked much more carefully at geography and was a positive study. I think it's not entirely clear why ramucirumab was a positive study and bevacizumab was a negative study, but the Bev study design, I think, was different, and we didn't know as much then as we do know now in terms of how to stratify these patients.
Right. And, you know, even taking a step back biologically, you know, do you view gastroesophageal cancer as more sort of angiogenically driven, more bloody kind of tumor that would be likely to benefit from this kind of strategy?
So, you know, I think that angiogenesis inhibitors play a role in this disease for sure. You know, they're not classically enhancing tumors on scans like you see in HCC and neuroendocrine tumors. I don't think that necessarily means they're not going to benefit from angiogenesis inhibitors. I think that how we design trials in this disease is really going to be important in the types of answers we get. So, for example, I think that there are still a number of U.S.-based academic oncologists that think that patients who live in North and South America may actually benefit from angiogenesis inhibitors, particularly bevacizumab. That was the population on a subset analysis in the Avogast trial that did show some additional benefit over patients in Asia. And though I don't think that question will really be asked again, unfortunately, I think bevacizumab is not going to be used in the future for treatment of gastroesophageal cancers, but I think that there is a future perhaps for other angiogenesis inhibitors.
Can you talk a little bit more about what's been seen in these two big trials looking at ramucirumab, where you think things might be heading, and, you know, how you think people are going to use it?
You know, what's, I think, really exciting about this is first, the first study looking at ramucirumab versus placebo in the second line study really demonstrates, A, you can accrue to second line trial in gastroesophageal cancer that's metastatic. And I think we're seeing now there are patients who are robust enough to receive second line treatment. And that's exciting. And then the question of the next study was looking at ramucirumab with paclitaxel that demonstrated that combination was better than paclitaxel alone, also in the second line setting. So the question is, you know, can you continue pairing it with other cytotoxic backbones? I think a lot of people will probably extrapolate and end up pairing it with other cytotoxic without there being data. That's being done a fair amount with trastuzumab. So trastuzumab in the TOGA trial was paired with platinum and fluoropyrimidine. Many of us, because we know that it's safe in the breast setting, pairing it with other cytotoxics or using it with other cytotoxic backbones. So I guess the question is, can you use ramucirumab with other cytotoxics? Can it be paired with other biologics that are not angiogenesis inhibitors? Could you pair it, for example, with a HER2-directed agent? Can you use it in other settings, like the adjuvant setting? So I think there's so many ways to look at ramucirumab, and I'm really excited that I'm sure that future trials will be looking at that.
Any sense about, you know, whether strategically it would make more sense to use it as monotherapy or with chemotherapy?
It's a good question. You know, I think some of that really depends on what line you're using it in. I think so patients in the first line setting really tend to be more robust. So let me, if I can, Neil, just back up a little bit just in talking about cytotoxic chemotherapy in metastatic disease, because there's considerable debate around that and even what cytotoxic backbones to use. So the textbook answer on a multiple choice question would often be using a triplet of cytotoxic chemotherapy. So the REAL trial looked at four different arms looking at a combination of basically it was ECF, I'm going to mix up all of the four, but essentially it was a trial to look at non-inferiority of cisplatin and oxaliplatin versus capecitabine and 5-FU, and the epirubicin was the same in all four arms. And so that demonstrated non-inferiority, essentially that the less toxic drugs, so oxaliplatin being less toxic and a little bit easier than cisplatin, was non-inferior, and capecitabine, which was non-inferior to 5-FU. And so I think many people use this EOX regimen, so epirubicin, oxaliplatin, and capecitabine in the treatment of metastatic disease. That is in the NCCN guidelines as really one of the Category 1 recommendations. Though if you pull a number of oncologists, I think many of us choose to only use two cytotoxic, so a doublet cytotoxic. If we're just using cytotoxic chemotherapy in the metastatic setting, most patients are not robust enough to handle the epirubicin. I almost never use it. So then really the question is, how do you build future trials with biologics? What cytotoxic backbones do you use? My practice is to use platinum fluoropyrimidine combinations in the first line setting. There are a number of options to use, FOLFOX, ELOX. I think those are common ones. And then in the second line setting, I think a very common choice is using a taxane as a single agent. We've seen also data over recent years showing that in the second line setting that that's better than best supportive care. And then how can you build on that in the second and third line settings? And I think that the patients just get sicker. So combination therapy typically is more toxic, though if you can combine perhaps biologics that maybe don't have quite as much toxicity, maybe you can balance that. But I think this patient population is challenging, sort of along the lines of pancreas. It's just hard to study combination therapies in second and third line setting.
Yeah, no, I also think about non-small cell, just, you know, people are so sick and they die so quickly, it seems like even though you're in the second line palliative situation that I'm not going to say you want to use all your guns up front, but, you know, if you've got a biologic that's going to add something onto it, maybe the time to use it is earlier.
It's a great question. So can you achieve better tumor response in the first line and then sort of go to a maintenance regimen? I think that that's also an important question. Can you preserve side effects for these patients by achieving responses and then put them on something a little bit easier? I think that at least initially, I may use it as a single agent. I really like sequential treatments. For me, it feels like it leaves options open. I don't like kind of using all of my options up all at once and then I'm left with, well, hey, I used them all three together. How do I treat my patient? I mean, that holds true in pancreas. You know, with FOLFIRINOX, you kind of use up all three of your really active cytotoxics and then you're kind of left with, I mean, now we have nab-paclitaxel to use as well, but So I really like sequential use of treatment. So I think first line, platinum fluoropyrimidine, second line, maybe a taxane, third line, maybe when patients are sicker, using a biologic in the third line setting that may not have as much toxicity, I think makes sense right now. For patients who can tolerate combinations, perhaps I would combine that with paclitaxel, as we know that we have data for that right now.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about GI NET. And first, maybe I can just ask you, just providing a little bit of a global view. I'm sure you give lectures on this all the time, in terms of particularly some of the things that you think maybe people, you know, are kind of missing. It is very uncommon, and docs in practice don't see it very often. Any sort of myths or misperceptions out there that you might want to comment on?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. So neuroendocrine tumors, I think that really two key take-homes for community oncologists and really decision branch points are they, first of all, poorly differentiated or well differentiated? And that, again, kind of going back to an earlier conversation about pathologists, we so rely on our pathologists to tell us this. And a couple of years ago, I think it was in, gosh, now it's 4 years ago, 2010, some pathology guidelines came out on minimum required data elements that should be in a neuroendocrine tumor path report. So some of the keys are grade, so low, intermediate, or high grade, Ki-67, which is a proliferative index, and mitotic index are some of the key features. And if your pathologists don't report those, go back and ask them to, because I think that it's important to help prognosticate. It puts patients in different treatment categories. So for example, patients with well-differentiated, which include both the low and intermediate grade, get treated very differently than patients with poorly differentiated tumors. Those patients get treated with a small cell-like regimen with platinum etoposide, and the well-differentiated patients get treated differently, and I'm sure we'll get to that. The second main branch point, at least for GI neuroendocrine tumors, is do they have pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor, or is it other? So meaning small bowel, or gosh, you can even kind of go outside the GI tract, bronchial. So anything outside of the pancreas is sort of lumped. Once upon a time, years ago, we lumped all neuroendocrine tumors together. And I think, you know, really one of the themes across all oncology is that we're now learning that we really can't lump things so much. We can put them in molecular buckets. We could put them in other disease site buckets. But I think that we will have more successes in our clinical trials if we're putting patients in the right buckets. And I think for neuroendocrine tumors now, the clinical trial design does not lump them. They are either well-differentiated or poorly differentiated, and they're either pancreas or non-pancreas. So that's, I would say, two big keys.
So maybe we can get a little bit more into this by talking about the case that you brought here. You're a 50-year-old lady.
Sure. So this was a woman who had really a diagnostic dilemma. This was a case I received actually from a community oncologist when I was giving a lecture. He's like, hey, I need some help with this case. So I will admit it's not my case, but I thought it was really illustrative of a number of points. So she had a profound symptomatic anemia and really could not find the bleeding source. She had an extensive workup, including a CT, chest, abdomen, pelvis that was negative, a PET scan that was negative, an EGD, colo, both of which were negative. And finally, she underwent a small bowel enteroscopy that found a nodule in the terminal ileum that was biopsied, and the pathology showed a well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor with a low Ki-67. And because the scan showed no evidence of metastatic disease, the patient was taken to the operating room for a right hemicolectomy that was in hopes of being a curative surgery. 10 out of 12 lymph nodes were positive. And in fact, at the time of surgery, low volume liver metastases were found. So often miliary or very small nodules, even if they're throughout the liver, are very difficult to see on standard cross-sectional imaging. And so the patient was started by their oncologist on long-acting octreotide monthly at 30 milligrams. And they said, hey, was this the right thing to do? And I think that there are a number of really important teaching points out of this particular case. One, I might comment first on imaging these patients. And so I think that one important take-home is that I can't fault the doctors who are working them up. They didn't know the patient had a neuroendocrine tumor to begin with. But I think once you know that, doing a multiphasic CT scan is important. As we'd spoken earlier, neuroendocrine tumors are very vascular. They tend to enhance on the arterial phase. And so multiphasic scans include both a venous, arterial, and delayed imaging. And so that's really important. And then also MRI is reasonable for these patients. It's a very good imaging modality. Octrea scans, I think, can be helpful, though also will not be picking up low volume disease. And then there is a new imaging modality that is starting to make its way into clinical practice in the United States. It's called a gallium 68 PET scan. It's used pretty routinely in Europe. It's a much more sensitive nuclear medicine tool, and it does help us pick up smaller volume disease, and we're starting to use that. It's only available in limited centers. We're starting to use it now some preoperatively for some of these patients. So I think that's one point.
So I guess the thinking was that this was bleeding, and that was where the anemia
was, and I think there were some stigmata of bleeding around this nodule, so it was felt to be the source of bleeding, yes.
So just out of curiosity, in this case, the patient was symptomatic from their primary, but sort of the same kind of situation, but let's say there was no bleeding, you know, it was picked up some other way, and you did document the metastatic disease, still, you know, patient asymptomatic, other than, I guess in this case, there wouldn't be the anemia. I guess basically my question is, when you have asymptomatic metastatic disease with a primary, do you always take out the primary?
That's a good question. So no. I think that if the patient has really extensive metastatic disease, so typically a lot of GI neuroendocrine tumors will spread to the liver. Sometimes you'll see peritoneal disease or bulky lymph nodes. The rule of thumb is that if about 90% of metastatic disease can be removed, that sort of debulking or volume reduction is considered reasonable. If you cannot, then in an otherwise asymptomatic patient who does not have progressive disease, we often will do active surveillance where we monitor patients with serial imaging and don't even necessarily start any treatment until they have symptoms, you know, more progressive disease, or if they have symptoms of tumor bulk.
How hard do you look for a primary in a patient who presents with metastatic disease? You biopsy, you know they have metastatic disease, you don't see an obvious primary. How hard do you look for it?
You know, I think it's becoming increasingly important to look for a primary. I think once, you know, years ago when we were lumping all of these tumors and treating them the same, I think that didn't matter as much. But now, because our clinical trials are designed in a way that really separate pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors from other, and because FDA approvals are based on those indications, I think it's more and more important to really identify a primary. That can sometimes be challenging. Even after a really long look, you may still find patients with unknown primaries. But I think some of our newer tools, whether they're endoscopic, like doing small bowel enteroscopies, or EGD with endoscopic ultrasounds, or the gallium 68 PETs, I think can sometimes help identify primaries.
I don't know how often you see this kind of situation, but if you do have a situation where you have a primary GI NET and you don't have metastatic disease, is there any role for some kind of adjuvant therapy?
So in this case, we'll pretend he didn't have metastatic disease. So currently in 2014, even with lymph node positive disease, there's no known role for adjuvant therapy. You know, and I think some of this depends a little bit on the pathology. So let's say this was a patient who we were surprised and found that they ultimately had a poorly differentiated tumor at the time of resection. Those patients, you would probably offer some form of adjuvant therapy in the form of a platinum etoposide combination. But for patients with a well-differentiated tumor, even with node-positive disease, we would not offer them adjuvant therapy. But, you know, it's a question that's being asked now in the form of a clinical trial. Not exactly the setting, but at least we're starting to ask it. So for patients with metastatic pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, for whom have an R0 or R1 resection of metastatic disease in the liver, so trying to render them disease-free surgically, there's a new ECOG study that's randomizing those patients to everolimus versus placebo for 12 months. And this is exciting because it's the first time we're trying to ask an adjuvant question. And my hope is that after the completion of that study, we can then think about looking at that in earlier disease settings. So in the true adjuvant setting, can we look at using some of these biologics? The question, though, I think really is parallel to what we've learned in GI stromal tumors. So would we just be really pushing out the recurrence. I mean, these are cytostatic agents, typically the biologics, not cytotoxic. You know, how are we really impacting the natural history in a slow-growing disease by giving them just a year of adjuvant therapy? It's hard to know.
Now, what about octreotide as adjuvant therapy? And what did you say to this doc who put the patient on octreotide?
Oh, yeah. Back to the case. Yes. You know, so there's no known role for giving it adjuvantly, unless, of course, the patient has symptoms of hormone excess. So I think that would be really the only known role for this patient. So we know that it can control symptoms of true carcinoid syndrome, like diarrhea and flushing, but this patient did not have that. I don't know what his serum or urine markers were preoperatively. Those we would absolutely recommend doing. We know that somatostatin analogs do have both an effect on controlling hormones, but also an anti-proliferative effect. So that's, I think, been a big advance in the last few years. So back, I think it was in 2009, the PROMID study looked at a patient population of metastatic small bowel neuroendocrine tumors, and they were randomized to receive octreotide or placebo, and those patients had prolonged progression-free survival who were on the octreotide arm. And so in that setting, that's often my first-line choice for patients with kind of slowly progressive disease. We also now know the CLARINET study, though it hasn't formally been published, has been presented at some international meetings. That was a more heterogeneous population that included pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors and used lanreotide, so a slightly different somatostatin analog. They have different affinities for the five somatostatin receptors. And that also was a positive study, so showed prolonged progression-free survival in that patient population. So I think another, I guess, to distill that, a key take-home for choosing which patients are appropriate for treatment with neuroendocrine tumors, it's really patients who have progressive disease, symptomatic from their, like hormone-related symptoms from their disease or symptoms from tumor bulk. So a newly diagnosed patient with metastatic disease who is not clearly progressing and asymptomatic, I wouldn't offer them any treatment. Sometimes you'll meet patients, though, newly diagnosed and you have no idea if they're progressing or not. I then will typically get a short interval follow-up scan and determine are they indeed progressing. But lots of these folks have had disease for years and we don't need to embark on treatment so soon.
What's your sort of basic algorithm to the use of systemic therapy for metastatic disease in terms of choice of type of agent and which one comes first, both in pancreatic and carcinoid?
So great question, and one that really we don't have a good answer for. I think that these patients will go on to get many treatments in their lifetime, and the sequence of these treatments is not known. I'm really hopeful that a question about sequence will be asked in a future clinical trial. So let me talk about kind of what tools we have in our toolbox for treating this disease. So for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, the formerly FDA-approved agents are everolimus, so it's an oral mTOR inhibitor, sunitinib, an oral VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and they're used separately, not together. They're taken orally daily, and both showed about a 5 to 6 month benefit in progression-free survival compared to placebo. And whether you choose one or the other, I think sometimes depends on the patient's comorbidities. So for example, I'm thinking about using sunitinib in a patient. If they have existing hypertension or existing bleeding disorder, I might be a little wary about starting that. It's not a strict contraindication, but perhaps that might push me towards starting everolimus first. Everolimus can sometimes cause lipid disorders. I have seen patients develop some problems with hypertriglyceridemia, so you might think about that. If they have pre-existing lung conditions, everolimus can sometimes cause pneumonitis. So I think that you maybe look at your patient and think about what you might consider using.
What about chemotherapy?
So chemotherapy, back decades ago, streptozocin was really one of the only, and is still the only FDA-approved cytotoxic chemotherapy. It's an alkylating agent. It is well thought to have considerable toxicity. It's not actually widely available even nowadays. It's hard to get. And gosh, I've probably used it twice ever. And so I think that we've been trying to look at newer, less toxic cytotoxic therapies. So in the last few years, what has become I think, of interest to this group is the use of temozolomide, which is an oral alkylating agent used and approved in glioblastoma, and it paired with capecitabine, so two oral agents. And Dr. John Strasberg published a retrospective review of his experience using this regimen. This was a small retrospective study, but in 30 patients with pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, there was a 70% response rate. So that was incredible. And Dr. Robert Fine in Columbia has also used this regimen pretty extensively, reported similar response rates. This has not been well studied in a rigorous way prospectively. So in the cooperative group setting, we were very interested in looking at this prospectively for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. We have a new ongoing study right now that is randomizing patients with metastatic pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors to receive temozolomide alone. So it's 5 days out of a 28-day cycle versus temozolomide and capecitabine together. There's some thought that the use of them together may be synergistic, but it's also not well known. I think another important question in that trial is looking at biomarkers that can predict for a response. So like in GBM, they look at MGMT deficiency, and so that will be looked at prospectively in that clinical trial. So anecdotally, I think many of us who treat the disease have seen some really great prolonged effects from the combination of temozolomide and capecitabine. It's very well tolerated. My colleagues in Europe actually use that combination before they even go to the biologics because they think that it's actually better tolerated than everolimus and sunitinib.
Any comments on radio-labeled octreotide?
Oh, yeah. So again, kind of looking, our colleagues in Europe have really pioneered a lot of the work in neuroendocrine tumors. So radiolabeled octreotide or somatostatin analogs has been used for a long time in Europe. And there are a number of high volume centers, Basel, Switzerland, Erasmus, Netherlands, Bad Berka, Germany, are kind of the three main centers that do this, looking at a treatment called PRRT. So it's peptide receptor radionuclide therapy. So it's essentially a somatostatin analog linked to a radioisotope, and usually either lutetium or yttrium. And it's infused intravenously. So for patients with octreotide positive disease, either determined by an octreotide scan or a gallium 68 scan, they are given this treatment intravenously. It's, again, not really been well studied prospectively. They have decades of retrospective experience. And so there's now a big multinational study called the NETTER-1 study that is ongoing. It just very recently started, but it is accruing very well across the U.S. and is available. I don't know how many centers in the U.S., but it's about 15. And it's just for patients with midgut or small bowel neuroendocrine tumors for this first trial. And it's a randomized study, randomizing patients to receive PRRT or high-dose octreotide at 60 milligrams. So that's double really the standard dose. I think it's a really exciting study. And, you know, obviously it will be a while before we know those results, but it really is the first time this is being asked prospectively.
There was some data presented on this modality at ASCO. Have clear-cut objective responses been reported?
Yes.
What kind of durations?
So again, some of this is just anecdotally patients that I've taken care of and seen, but it can be years.
And is it actually available outside a trial setting in the United States?
No, sadly. So I actually have patients that will go to Europe to get the treatment. It's not covered by insurance, but they will welcome U.S. patients over there. I think back to a question you'd asked me earlier, what's the right timing and sequence for using this treatment early in the disease course, late in the disease course? We don't know. And I think because we have some treatments that are FDA approved and proven in a more rigorous way, I tend to go to those first. And if a patient, you know, A, if they're eligible for this trial, we're talking about that earlier, but if they want to think about getting PRRT in Europe, I typically do that later in the disease course.